very much. It's an honor to have been invited to participate in this APHA meeting. Larry Apple talked about the scientific case for reducing the sodium consumption, and Roland Sturm talked about the health and economic benefits that would fall out of such reductions. I want to talk about the history, mostly the regulatory history of sodium reductions, and what's going on now, what we can look forward to, what are some of the options for actually achieving those reductions that would provide multi-billion dollar annual benefits and great improvements in the public's health. We've seen where the sodium comes from. 75% or so comes from processed and packaged in restaurant foods. This is no relationships to disclose. Here's some examples of packaged foods that have large amounts of sodium. You can use, the food label says 2,400 milligrams should be your daily limit. Expert panels have recommended for most adults, most of us in this audience, no more than 1,500 milligrams a day. And you see that if you use the 1,500 milligram figure, numerous servings of these of packaged foods provide you with two-thirds of a daily recommended limit of sodium. This looks bad, but it's not bad. If you go to restaurant foods, it just knocks your socks off. Go to Denny's for a breakfast, 3,800 milligrams. A typical Reuben sandwich at a deli, 3,300 milligrams. Dunkin' Donuts salt bagel, you know, I admit I'm putting my finger on the scale a little bit here, 3,500 milligrams. And an order of house lo mein at a Chinese restaurant, 3,500 milligrams. Awesome amounts of sodium from many, many foods. So what has been done to regulate salt over the years, or sodium intake? In 1958, Congress passed food additive amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and it created a category of substances that Congress and the FDA felt didn't need to be regulated, stuff that was just, you know, everybody knew it was safe, like salt and sugar and partially hydrogenated oil and other stuff like vinegar and citric acid and ascorbic acid and so on. So they set up a category called generally recognized as safe, and salt was considered generally recognized as safe, and there were no limits put on its use in any product. CSPI actually was created in 1971, and we began looking at nutrition a few years later, and we discovered all kinds of evidence that salt promoted high blood pressure, and high blood pressure caused heart attacks and strokes. So in 1978, we petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to revoke that GRAS status of salt, to set limits on sodium levels in different categories of foods, to put warning notices on certain high sodium products, and to mount an education campaign. The very next year, 1979, the FDA's own advisory committee said salt should not be considered generally recognized as safe. The evidence isn't sufficient to substantiate that. And the next year, the first Dietary Guidelines for Americans said, avoid excess salt. And it has said the same thing every 5 years ever since. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected president and chose a commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration who happened to be a hypertension expert, Arthur Hull Hayes. And he wanted to do something about salt, but he couldn't regulate because it was the Reagan administration. So he said, let's do things voluntarily. One thing that they didn't do was respond to our petition to regulate salt. So we sued the FDA in 1982, and the FDA said, hey, you know, we want to do things voluntarily. Give us a chance. We just are starting this. And the FDA actually did a little bit. They had an article in their magazine. The commissioner gave a few speeches. And they There was a primitive nutrition labeling back then that was on about half of all foods, and the FDA said, if you're going to provide nutrition labeling, you have to include sodium. It was small, unreadable print. And the court said, hey, sounds good to us. Let's, Jacobson, get out of here. Let's give this voluntary approach a chance, and let's see if it works. So a few years later, the FDA looked at this. It looked at the sodium, how sodium levels changed between 1981 and 1986, and it concluded that industry had not reduced the sodium content of established product lines. The FDA really didn't do anything after this announcement that their voluntary approach didn't work. But in 1990, Congress passed the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act that led to some labeling requirements. So sodium, as well as cholesterol and calories and other nutrients, had to be listed on almost all packaged foods beginning in 1993. And particularly relevant for sodium is that the FDA came out with definitions for reduced sodium, low sodium, sodium-free, salt-free, and those kinds of statements. And after that, not much, for the next decade, not much happened. But in 2004, as was mentioned earlier, the British government developed a major campaign to reduce sodium. And it was voluntary reductions, because Britain doesn't have the right within the framework of the European Union to actually regulate. But they set targets for about 80 or 85 categories of foods and shot and aimed for a 33% reduction over 5 years, 50% over 10 years. And in the first few years, they got about a 10% reduction in the sodium levels in packaged and restaurant foods. That was, I think it was 2008 that those urinary excretion studies were done. And that sent a very major signal to multinational food processors like McDonald's, Kraft, Unilever, Nestle, companies that do a lot of business outside of Britain, and that told them that they really were going to be under the gun. The same year, 2004, Havas and collaborators, including the director of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, estimated that a 50% reduction in sodium would save about 150,000 lives per year. Major. And I think that helped establish, it was a very clear number, it helped establish that salt and sodium more broadly is probably the single most harmful thing in the American food supply. And I would put an error bar of probably 50,000 lives per year on that 100,000. And those actions, the Havas publication and the British government reminded us, CSPI, that the FDA really had never responded to our petition. So we went back to court and asked the court to require the FDA to respond to our petition. The court said, it's 20 years old, get out of here. And so we re-petitioned the FDA with essentially the same petition, revoke the GRAS status, require set limits for different categories of foods, mount an education campaign, warning labels. And this time the FDA responded not with a, okay, we'll do it, or no, we're not going to do it, but they held a major public hearing on sodium reduction at which the British officials testified. And New York City said at that hearing that the FDA should urge cuts and regulate if necessary. And that kind of announced the New York City, beginning of the New York City's interest in sodium reduction. So in the last few years, there's been a lot of interest, Britain, scientific publications, a lot more research, FDA public hearing. Let's go back and see what's happened to sodium levels. We had happened to take a look at sodium levels in 529 foods in 2005, And so we went back in 2008 and looked at sodium levels and found essentially no change in sodium content. Earlier this month, Bernstein and Willett published a paper that looked at summarized all the urinary excretion studies that they could find over the past 50 years and concluded that there was no change in sodium consumption, and that average consumption has been about 4,000 milligrams per day, which adds about their average was, I think, 3,750 milligrams in the urine, and they estimated about 5% losses through the stools and sweat. So, and that 4,000 is a little higher than the N. Haynes dietary consumption, dietary recall studies, which show 3,400 milligrams. So let's continue with this regulatory history. Larry mentioned the IOM report, the most important report that has been published on sodium. It concluded that the voluntary approach has been tried. Recommendations had been made to reduce sodium since 1969, and they were ignored. Nothing changed. And therefore, the government had to go on a mandatory route and set limits, gradually declining limits over some period of years. Shortly after that, New York City announced its voluntary sodium targets, and I'll show you a few in a couple of minutes. And the FDA said that sodium reduction is a high priority. And the question is, well, what's it going to do? So right now they're in a study phase. I understand they've hired half a dozen people to see where sodium is coming from and do modeling to see where sodium reductions were most feasible. There's a lot, you know, sometimes people think, oh, it's so hard to reduce sodium, but there's actually a lot of low-hanging fruit out there when you compare one brand to another of the same food. Why does Hunt's need five times as much sodium in its tomato paste as Contadina's? Why does Campbell need three times as much sodium as Wolfgang Puck's in their vegetable soups? Why does Quaker need three times as much sodium in its corn rice snacks as Safeway? And I think that there's no sense to this. I think companies added a certain amount of sodium, they concocted their recipes 10 years ago, 50 years ago, whatever it is, and just stuck with it because nobody questioned it. And it was partly on the basis of these kinds of brand-to-brand differences on seemingly identical products that New York City came up with their sodium targets. And they said, look, some companies have twice as much sodium or 50% more sodium in their rolls than another company. The company with more sodium could easily reduce those and still have a perfectly marketable product. And those brand-to-brand differences vary greatly from category to category, and in some categories, there's no difference. In some products, there's no difference at all. Milk, for instance, you're not going to reduce sodium in milk. So New York said, okay, for bread and rolls, let's go from 485 milligrams now to, in 2 years, let's make a 10% reduction, and in 4 years, let's make a whatever percent reduction that is, 25% or so. Breakfast cereals, you can do a bigger percentage reduction. And soups, you can do a 30% or so reduction. So New York did that for many products. Unfortunately, New York's sodium reduction initiative has not had much of a buy-in from industry. Only a few companies, I think 15 or 20 companies, said we'll cooperate. And for many of those companies, they said, okay, we'll do it for our vegetable bouillon. A rifle shot rather than all their product categories. And since the Institute of Medicine report came out, I think the focus has really gone from the New York City initiative, NSRI, to what is the federal government going to do? Now, and you know, the FDA can do a lot, but I just wanted to mention that cities and states also can do a lot. You know, most simply, cost nothing, urge the FDA to set sodium limits, implement the IOM's recommendation. It could urge Congress to hold hearings on sodium, the importance of sodium, and what's government doing about it. Some cities and states are setting limits, procurement standards for sodium in all the foods that the city or state has some role in. Prisons, government cafeterias, schools, hospitals, and so on. And it could call on companies to voluntarily lower sodium or face regulatory action. They can go, cities and states could go further. They can require warning notices on high sodium foods or notices on shelf markers at supermarkets. And the same thing for restaurant foods. Cities and states have the authority to require warning notices on menus if sodium exceeds some particular level. And in terms of the voluntary stuff, I should mention that some companies are making modest efforts, and they're proposing typically 20% reductions over the next 5 years, which is very significant if they follow through, not nearly as rapid a reduction as is desirable. This category to category kinds of changes in regulations are complicated, and I wanted to mention quickly another approach, which would be cap and reduce sodium. And it does away with all that, breakfast cereals, you do this, bread and rolls, you do that, cheese, you do this. It would say, this approach would say, okay, we're using 1.5 billion tons of salt per year. Let's reduce that by 5% a year for 10 years. And industry can fight over that salt. And that would ensure very significant reductions in salt, if not total sodium, on a given timetable. There's a lot of opposition to this, and this is an idea that hasn't gained traction. So let me give you my feeling on what ought to be done and what might be done, one other possible strategy. And that is industry should aggressively cut sodium levels. Some companies are moving in that direction, other companies are not, and there's no enforcement, but this is free, it lets companies do whatever they want to do. FDA and USDA both need to be involved. USDA governs about 20% of the food supply. Chicken pot pies, ham, bacon, sodium-injected chickens, and all of that. The two agencies need to work together. The lawyers at FDA in particular and USDA need to figure out exactly what can be done. Where do they have the legal authority? Where do regulations conflict? So there's some regulations, like for bread. It's an FDA definition of bread that says you can use as much sodium as you want. That would have to be changed along with some other regulations. So it can get complicated. The lawyers need to figure out the details. The federal government should get cities and states with their procurement standards and so on to be part of the solution. And the feds are developing procurement standards also. That could have a tremendous impact if sodium and saturated fat and so on are gradually reduced. And I think what's really needed is a simultaneous voluntary and regulatory approach. The regulatory approach is going to take many, many years with economic analyses, to measure the costs and the benefits. There are proposals, there are advance notice of proposed rulemakings, there are public comment periods, there is then final regulations, there can be lawsuits. This can go on easily 10 years. So you want to get industry doing as much as it can on a voluntary basis. The I don't think that limiting the overall use of salt has any viability at all. Now, there's another regulator out there that's worth mentioning, and that is the biggest buyers of food in the country, and that is supermarkets. Large supermarket chains have tremendous power, companies like Walmart, Costco, Target. They could go to Procter & Gamble or General Mills, Kellogg, and say, hey, we're not going to buy your food unless it has less than this much salt in your soup or your baking mixes or whatever. So it'll be interesting to see if those companies step up to the plate. And some of them have shown a real interest in environmental and health issues. The final thing that I haven't talked about at all, except in an indirect way, is the courts. And that's another place to get some traction. Here's Denny's. Here's a meal at Denny's. 1,300 milligrams from the soup, 3,800 milligrams from the chicken sandwich, 1,000 from the fries, and top it off with a little apple pie, 6,600 milligrams of sodium. And they don't tell consumers, diners, that that's what they're going to get. We sued Denny's about a year ago, and this is still in court, saying Denny's should either lower sodium levels or it should put a warning notice on its menus on its high sodium meals. And we didn't specify a limit, but you could think, okay, anything more than a daily limit of sodium would be reasonable for one meal. So we have to see how this Denny's lawsuit plays out, and we have lots of other candidates for litigation in the pipeline. So we'll see what happens. But I think we're on the right track to lowering sodium. It's going to be a long, hard haul. We shouldn't hold our breaths. Getting to 1,500 is, I don't know if any of us will see it in our lifetimes, but at least we're on the right road. Thank you very much. Yes?
So obviously, individual voluntary approaches are weak, but you know, your newsletter and some of your strategies work with sort of the making it more practical, more palatable. Do you have some suggestions along those lines? I mean, obviously, you know, people have just gotten used to all the salt and the taste, you know, the whole argument that by the industry, of course, that things won't taste good. We just saw that article in the New York Times about the cheese being pushed to higher levels and higher saturated fat. How would you approach using that as sort of another arm of this in terms of really getting serious about helping people cook differently, you know, buy differently?
I think that approach of reaching individuals and encouraging dietary changes is useful. Some people will listen. Larry probably sticks to a lower sodium diet, and Roland does, and I do. But it's not the way to make change. The voluntary approach simply hasn't worked. With all the thousands of newspaper articles and so on. But I don't accept one of the things you said, that the taste has to suffer. It needn't. Some brands have twice as much salt, sodium, as another brand. Companies can make reductions without any difference in taste. McDonald's told me that they cut the sodium in chicken McNuggets sharply. In Britain, their sales went up. Today, Taco Bell announced that it had made a 23% reduction in sodium in all of its cheesy, salty products in their Dallas-Fort Worth stores. Nobody noticed the difference. They have 150 stores, no complaints, and they'll probably go national. So there's a lot of room for reduction. Whether they can go to 35% without anybody noticing, that's a different story.
Can I make a comment? There is what we call in our IO report like a sweet spot, because actually some foods, things taste worse with more sodium, you know, and we just have to sort of shift that curve a bit to the left.
Yes.
Well, what's the other scenario, what if manufacturers add things to their play cells that is more harmful than salt?
What? You mean arsenic? I mean, what's more harmful than salt? It's complicated because sodium is added to foods for many reasons. In some foods, it's a preservative. In cheese, you need salt to make it work. Baking powder is tough to get rid of all tough to make substantial reductions. So there are different tricks. Some cracker companies only salt one side of the cracker. Frito-Lay is coming up. They did some very interesting studies where they discovered on potato chips that there's a thin layer of oil on the potato chip, or thick layer of oil, and that and then they salt this greasy piece of potato. Some of the salt crystals are submerged in the oil because they're tiny salt crystals. You get sodium, but you don't get any taste. And so they're asking their suppliers to get rid of those very small sodium salt crystals, and they can lower sodium levels. In some products, salt is used to cover up bitterness, pasta sauce. If you use better tomatoes, you don't need as much salt. Potassium chloride can substitute for maybe 10%, 20% of salt. Gives you good potassium, but it tastes horrible if you use too much. And so there's a limit on how much they can use. So there are all these different tricks that companies can use sometimes to enhance the flavor and use less salt. Potassium chloride also could be dangerous if there's too much. Companies are working on salt enhancers that they would add to the food that would jack up the sensitivity of taste buds. It's used at parts per million levels, and that may be a way to reduce salt in some food. So there are all kinds of tricks. Yes? No. Kind of the easiest way for cities or states to have an impact is on the foods that they influence. So school meals, prisons, and so on. But for the general food supply, you know, McDonald's and General Mills, it's very tough for a local community to have an effect unless they required warning notices, and that would take some time. Yes?
I have a question about CSPI and
Yeah, generally they don't want to do more than one thing. And I think nutritionists also have a problem thinking of more than one thing. So, you know, for a while it was saturated fat, and then a couple of years it was whole grains. Trans fat, fortunately, the battle is more than half won. And it's very hard to get government to do something because they say, oh, things are going in the right direction, so we don't have to do anything. But, and FDA should ban trans fat. It can do it very easily, partially hydrogenated oil. The big companies have made changes, but I think thousands and thousands of small restaurants and producers have not changed their products. So when we were really working on trans fat, it was harder to get attention to other issues. But this is salt's day, you know. Go get them. You know that there's nothing else in the food supply that's more important than reducing sodium. But I wouldn't say we shouldn't do other things. We're trying to get companies to stop using food dyes because they cause hyperactivity in kids and possibly cancer in anybody. And the British government, again, was the first out there. It has and the European Union is now requiring a warning notice, meaning that all over Europe, there very few foods contain dyes. Multinational companies like McDonald's don't use them over there, they use dyes here. So we're still going after dyes and some other things, but in terms of importance, how much effort should be made, I don't think anything is more important than salt, except some harder things, getting people to eat fruits and vegetables. How do you do that? Let's see, some big CDC grants to do that. I think that's tougher and probably maybe more important. Yes?
Many of the packaged foods that you talked about are really prevalent in low-income communities where their only access is bodegas or convenience stores or gas stations. So I'm wondering if the food access issue is a productive avenue to tackle the sodium issue.
Absolutely. People in low-income neighborhoods and rural communities need access to food that's just as junky as all Americans are eating. Probably better on average than what's in their bodega, and certainly supermarkets in major cities give access to fruits and vegetables. Some communities are tackling this problem. Congress authorized, but I don't think it's appropriated $400 million to solve the food desert problem. It's a very solvable problem, and it's something that needs a lot of work. And then simultaneously, let's improve the foods that supermarkets offer.
We have time for one more question.
At what level of manufacturing drop iodine out?
Say that, I couldn't hear, I'm sorry. Yeah. It is not widely used in by the manufacturers, but it is. But there's no iodine efficient or I should say, vanishingly little iodine deficiency in the United States. Larry could speak to this better than I could. If it turns out to be a significant problem, there's plenty of time for the government to encourage or require companies or certain companies to use iodized salt. So it's not considered a public health problem now. And let me just put in a little P.S., and I'll let Larry address that. Just a little P.S., I have a few copies of Nutrition Action Health Letter. I'll have them up here. And also an announcement of National Food Day next October that will try to address food deserts and animal welfare and nutrition, all things related to the food supply in a project along the lines of Earth Day. Huge thing, and I hope everybody participates. Larry, do you want to?